whistle and shriek, she recognizes the familiar sound the chimp is making. It is a warning call, a kind of siren that chimps emit when a threat is close. One is warning the others not to enter. After a moment, the apes break it up. The largest of them, who bizarrely seems to be wearing a ragged old red hat, Knuckle walks to the balcony railing and hops onto its edge, beckoning the others to follow. A moment later, all three of them slip over the railing and are gone. Chloe expels a long, shivery breath. First, the chimps wanted to attack, but then suddenly, they stopped. Attila. How could it have been him? How could it not have been him? How many chimps are there at large in this town? Chloe sits on the floor with Eli in the dark. Outside the shattered window, she can hear people yelling, people singing and chanting in Central Park. It is as if human beings are regressing, becoming primitive again. Maybe human beings will start reacting to the pheromones now. Create human zombies to join the four-footed ones. Anything is possible. Eli struggles in her arms like a giant fish, struggles to escape her grip.
No, stay here,
Chloe says in a curt whisper.
I'll be right back.
She thinks he needs to use the bathroom, but he returns a moment later and hands her something. It is the bowl of popcorn.
Daddy said I should take care of you while he's gone,
he says.
Here.
She kisses him. There comes a heavy, pounding knock on the door.
United States Army, a voice shouts. Is there anyone in there?
Chloe scoops up Eli and rushes to the door. A young blonde soldier with glasses smiles in the glow of his flashlight as she lets him in.
Thank God you're alive, ma'am, he says, lowering his rifle. Somebody turned off the electric fence, and they got in through the basement somehow. We think we have it under control now. Are you hurt? Is your son all right?
We are fine, Chloe says. Chimpanzees tried to get in through the balcony, but then they left.
So that's what they were, the soldier says, shaking his head. I knew I saw something jump over the perimeter fence from the second floor balcony.
Are many people hurt? The other families?
I'd be lying if I said no, the soldier said. Three families on the fourth floor seem to have taken the worst of it. There have been about a half dozen casualties so far. We're still sweeping.
In the meantime, the soldier says, offering her something. Chloe just stares at it. It is a flat black pistol.
We can't be everywhere at once, ma'am. You might need to use it to drive off the next wave.
What if I can't?
Then you might really need it, the soldier says, slapping it into her hand and turning to go. The gun lies dark, cold, and heavy in her hand. She hates to touch it. She knows all too well what he meant about needing it. He meant that she should use it on Eli and herself, rather than be eaten alive.
Mommy, is that a real gun?
Says Eli.
No.
Chapter 88. The message, as it has come to be called at the White House, is delivered the next day at 0900 and put on a loop to repeat for the rest of the day. On all TVs and radios, programming is interrupted. The message is broadcast through megaphones on helicopters and through the speakers on army vehicles roving the streets. An image of the Oval Office appears on the 40-foot LED screen at One Times Square. The 45th President of the United States of America, Marlena Grace Hartinson, sits behind the desk. Her smoky, dark green eyes look resolutely into the camera, and in a slow, careful voice, she begins.
My fellow Americans, I would like to say good morning to you, the President says. But as we all know, this isn't a very good morning for many of us. We are currently experiencing a dark moment in the annals of human history. I say this from hard-won personal knowledge. My own daughter, Allison, died yesterday. She was killed by our family pet. This is a tragedy that I and my husband, Richard, may never recover from. But we need to go on. We all do, and we will. That is what the United States of America does. Despite the efforts of our military all across our nation, and indeed, all across our planet, animals continue to attack human beings savagely and without cessation. Fortunately, after much careful research, our scientists believe they have discovered some of the responsible factors underlying these attacks. For many years,
There has been much heated debate over industrial pollution and its contribution to global warming. As we researched the dangers of industrial activity on climate change, it seems we were simultaneously overlooking another problem that has been developing unnoticed right under our noses for years. This problem amounts to the destabilization of the biosphere. It has come to light that the aberrant animal behavior may be directly related to human activity. The recent buildup of hydrocarbon-rich petroleum products, coupled with radiation from cellular phones, has caused changes in the environment, which these animals are reacting to. It has been explained to me that the hydrocarbons normally found in the human environment have subtly morphed into a substance that many animals' sensory faculties are interpreting as a pheromone, altering these animals' behaviors. These new airborne chemical particulates are causing animals to swarm together and attack human beings. It is undeniable that in the interest of public safety, we must do everything in our power to reverse this process. That is why I am asking for the people of the United States of America to come together with the rest of the world this morning. Though I know it will be a great hardship, for the next 2 weeks, we must cease the use of all cellular phones and electricity, and cease the burning of fossil fuels. In essence, we need to clear the air, literally, of both radiation and petroleum byproducts, if a first step in ending this disaster is to be made. I have just signed an emergency executive order stipulating that all cellular communication towers and power plants in the United States of America will be shut down as of midnight tonight. Except for hospitals and designated emergency personnel, the use of portable generators is banned. The driving of vehicles will also be prohibited, and any violators are subject to arrest. The heads of other major industrial nations, among them the United Kingdom, France, Russia, China, and Japan, have agreed to the same. You will be informed of any and all further instructions. This 2-week cessation is essential to allow our scientists to confirm the causes of human-animal conflict, and for us to formulate a coordinated plan for the future. Thank you for your cooperation. God bless America, and God bless us all. Chapter 89. When the president's speech came on, Charles Groh and I were downstairs in the Navy mess drinking coffee and trying to brainstorm. It was more of a light brain shower. We were too spent and frazzled to stir up a storm. Really, we were just waiting and watching until the minute hand oozed into place to form the perfect backward L of 9 o'clock, and we followed the scuttling commotion into the adjoining stainless steel kitchen and gathered with the crowd of kitchen staff where they stood, vigilant and hushed, beneath a TV mounted to the wall. When the broadcast was over, the crowd dissolved into anxious murmurs.
"The power's going out and the army's going to lock people up for driving their cars," said a portly black chef. Somebody switched off the TV. "That's the brilliant new plan?"
He seemed skeptical. Everyone did. I was skeptical too, and I was the primary architect of the brilliant new plan.
"How does it feel?"
said Dr. Groh as we arrived back at our table in the nearly empty dining room. "How does what feel?"
"To finally get what you want," he said. "You've been trying to warn people for how long? A decade almost? Now they're listening. It's got to be pretty weird to finally get what you want.
I just hope it's what we need." I drank the last of my coffee and looked at the sludge in the bottom of the paper cup as though I were a gypsy reading tea leaves. I thought about it. My feelings were definitely of the mixed variety. I was glad the idiotic carpet bombing campaign had been stopped, but the problem was that my petroleum radiation pheromone theory was still just that, a theory. There was a strong possibility I could be completely wrong or only half right. It was impossible to rule out other factors contributing to the problem. It was even possible that radiation, electricity, and petroleum had nothing to do with it, that we'd just been barking up the wrong tree. Ha ha. Science is like that. It doesn't have the answers. It guesses, tests, and guesses again. I had my guesses, and now they were going to be tested. Turning off the world's lights was an unprecedented, historic event. What if it didn't work?
"It feels like the weight of the world is on my shoulders, Charles," I said. "I'm pretty much scared shitless."
Dr. Groh shrugged. When we returned to the cabinet room for another round of meetings,
Everyone seemed dazed, exhausted. But it was the kind of upbeat dazed and exhausted you see in people racing to meet a deadline, the pizza box and black coffee all-nighter, the burned-out look of dedicated people in the final push of getting something difficult done. When the president walked in, a spontaneous burst of applause filled the crowded room. But as the energy secretary whistled through pinched fingers, I kept my hands at my sides. This wasn't the end of something. This was just the very beginning of what I anticipated was going to be a long, hard journey. I couldn't quite join in the self-congratulation just yet. Because letting the public know was one thing, getting them to comply was quite another. In order for this to work, people had to actually stop using electricity and driving cars. Would they? It all depended upon people observing the new emergency ordinances. Realistically, there were nowhere near enough boots on the ground to enforce these contingency laws, so all we could do was to count on people to cooperate. In officer training, one of the first things they tell you is to never give an order unless you're sure it will be obeyed. If a law cannot be enforced, it's easy for it to crumble. As Frederick the Great said, "Diplomacy without arms is like music without instruments." As the president found her seat in the middle of the room, I tried to think of other instances in which Americans had been called upon to sacrifice for the good of the country, or of the world, as the case may be. World War II is a good example. I also remembered all the charity and camaraderie that had abounded in New York after 9/11. It could happen again, right? I crossed my fingers under the table as President Hardinson cleared her throat. I hoped so. I prayed so. It was all up to us now.
Chapter 90. Because of electrical load and supply concerns, large-scale power grids take time to shut down without damaging the equipment. It isn't until 12 hours after the president's stated deadline that the U.S. grid has fully powered down. The rolling blackout had caught some people unawares. Water pumps had failed in some areas and people were stuck in elevators as everything ground to a standstill. And then there was silence and darkness. But most people were ready for it. By 2100 EDT, every power plant, airline, and factory in the United States and Europe is powered down, as well as every commercial cellular communication site. In the United States, Army units are deployed to stop all vehicular traffic. For the first time ever, the U.S. Air Force Space and Missile System satellite that monitors nighttime data shows only blackness where those twinkling crystalline spider webs of light used to be. New York, London, Paris. Dark. At the break of rosy-fingered dawn in the Virunga Mountains of Rwanda, Barbara Hatfield wakes inside a shipping container that her zoological research center used for storage. The primatologist had locked herself in it almost 3 weeks ago in order to avoid being ripped asunder by the band of gorillas she used to study. She is in dire straits. The container is a broiler by day and an icebox at night. Her food has run out. There is only 1 gallon of water left. She is weak, hungry, dehydrated. Isolated from the goings-on in the rest of the world, she does not understand why no one has come to her rescue. Why has the supply plane not been here in 3 weeks? Isolation, hunger, deprivation, fear. She is feverish, hallucinatory, the borders between reality, nightmare, and dream blurring and dissolving. She is being punished in some way by God, abandoned in the jungle to suffer and die. With great effort, she rolls over onto her hands and knees, crawls to the hole in the container by one of the hinges, and peeks through the slit of vision it offers her. What she sees amazes her. In the clearing near the edge of the tree line, she can see the gorillas, but the females are present again. When the craziness started, all the females seemed to have disappeared. Now they are back. The gorillas are no longer menacing. They are doing what they usually do, eating, mating, playing with their children, lazing in the grass. Barbara stands on spindly, weak legs and unlatches the container's door. She steps outside. The gorillas look up at her. Barbara rears back, stumbling. The hollow metal clangs and drums under her staggering feet, and she grasps the edge of the doorway, catching herself from falling. Should she head back to the safety of the container? Are they going to attack again? Then she stops and watches as the gorillas slowly lumber back into the jungle, vanishing into the trees and ground fog. In Delhi, the sun trickles over a sea of flat rooftops over a dark and quiet city. Strict government enforcement helps ensure compliance with the global energy ban. The two new power plants east of the city have been shut down, along with all the communications towers, the filling stations. In Yamuna Pushta, the sprawling slum east of the city, the usually traffic-clogged streets are empty of everything but pushcarts and rickshaws. The migrant people who inhabit the slum tentatively peek out from the cracks in their hovels. They have been easy pickings for the roving packs of pariah dogs and jungle cats that have overtaken the city. As they peer out from their hiding places, they see movement in the streets. Animals, leopards, tigers, are moving northward. A soot-faced child ducks fearfully beneath a window, then his head rises again to look at a passing leopard. Patient, lazy, its shoulder blades undulating, its tail a pendulum. It is walking away. The big cats are moving out of the city, returning to the jungles where they belong. All around the world, it is happening. In London, in Paris, in Rome, in Beirut, in Iowa City, animals are leaving the cities. Massive packs of animals are dissipating, going home like a crowd after a ball game. Chapter 91. Chloe has been up for 2 hours when the sun rises in New York on the second day of the global power freeze. With the electricity off, she lights a candle and spends the flat, empty stretch of time going through family photographs. She is glad she included them when she packed her bags for the government evacuation headquarters. She smiles to herself as she slowly turns the pages of her photo album. She can't decide which is her favorite, the wedding photos or the shot of Oz at the hospital holding Eli for the first time, or the one of a 2-year-old Eli chasing a seagull at a picnic on Jones Beach. She settles on the wedding picture of Oz waiting for her at the altar, a neon blue Hawaiian shirt under his tuxedo jacket. It is the expression on his face, she thinks, his smile, the glimmer in his brown eyes. They are a freeze frame of joy and life. God, she misses him. God, does it hurt to be apart? But she cannot go back to the panic and depression. She has to be hopeful. They will be together soon, she knows. Because it's working. The plan is working. The night before, she and some of the other scientists had gone onto the roof of the building. She had held Eli's warm, tiny hand in hers, and they looked up into the sky. They could see the stars. To Chloe, the starscape above was like a night sky in her girlhood home on her grandfather's farm in the French countryside. Eli was a city kid. He had never seen so many stars. She pointed out the constellations to him and the planets, Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, those winking faraway giants. The galaxy unfurled in a fluttering ribbon of star smoke. They could see the stars, of course, because every light in the city was off, even the streetlights. There was not a drop of electricity running in the city's veins. Chloe had listened for any remnant of the great vibration that had once been New York City. It was gone. There was only darkness and silence. The city was a coral shell of darkness and silence. And holding Eli's hand on the roof, Chloe had felt warm tears sliding out of the corner of her eyes and down her cheeks. Her tears had come partly from sadness and partly from the cold joy of seeing all this terrifying, useless, lonely beauty. Progress is being made, she thinks now, tracing a picture of her husband's face with a finger. She can feel it in her bones. They are going to make it through this. After breakfast, Chloe decides to take Eli onto their terrace for some fresh air. Just entering the room where the animals had almost gotten in makes her palms tingle with sweat, but she wills herself through it. Using a broom, she sweeps away the broken glass from the French doors, and then she opens them, and they are outside. It is a gorgeous September day. Clear blue sky, sunny, slightly breezy.
"Listen, Mommy,"
Eli says. She listens. The only sound is the swish of the wind pushing the leaves of the swaying Central Park trees.
"I don't hear anything, Eli."
"Yeah,"
he says.
"Someone turned New York off."
Chloe smiles. It's true. The streets are still, silent. Down Fifth Avenue, morning light trickles through the side streets to lie warm on the wide avenue in golden strips. There is something sad about it, and yet wonderful. Beyond the trees in the distance, the roof of the Plaza Hotel could almost be a Mayan temple. It is as if they have traveled back in time. Chloe puts her arms around her son, her small, bright, warm son. For a moment, for the first time in a long while, she feels halfway safe, halfway happy. She thinks about Oz again, the feel of his back under her fingers, his goofy American laugh. He is okay. She will see him again soon. She kisses her son, wiping the trembling jewel of a tear from the side of her nose. The world will not end. Chapter 92. Splayed on his back on a rock outcropping overlooking a softball field near the Central Park Carousel, Attila watches a high white cloud sail across the ocean of blue sky above him. He makes a soft, mewling whimper, an almost sigh. His shoulders droop, his muscles slacken. He is serene now. The massive pack of animals he led into Central Park several nights before has dwindled considerably. First, the rats left, and then the cats. There were a few dogs left, but even they are starting to circle in ever-widening loops, wandering aimlessly, like electrons in an unstable atom. The scent in the air that so strongly compelled Attila to act is weak now, just a tiny trace of what it had been. Racked, spent, limp with physical exhaustion, he dozes on the sunny rock. The aftertaste of blood in his mouth is strong, metallic, slightly nauseating. All he wants to do now is sleep, sleep, sleep. He dozes throughout the day, waking occasionally, watching the still and silent city, dozing some more. The soft light on the white buildings. His sweet, glassy brown eyes blink languidly. He listens to the quiet. The silence is beautiful. The cool, clean air. Though he is getting hungry, it is normal hunger. It is not a crazed death hunger. He doesn't want to kill now. The bloodlust has burned away like a fever. He is healing now. Soon he sits up as another chimp clambers up onto the rock and sits down beside him. She is a large female who escaped from the Central Park Zoo. She has something in her hand. It is an orange. It is like a ball of flame in her hand, a sun. She peels it with her long fingers and offers it to Attila. Attila breaks it in half and hands the other half back. Together, they eat the orange. The cool, sweet, sticky juice feels good in his mouth. The female cuddles next to him and begins grooming his fur. Soon, they are lying there together on the warm stone. Feeling her warmth and the warmth of the earth, Attila is at peace. He closes his eyes and slips back into sleep. Chapter 93. Two more days of meeting slid by like sludge. It was difficult to see by lantern and candlelight, and hot indoors. So, the meetings were held outside, in the Rose Garden. We sat around the tables on springy metal outdoor furniture, using paperweights to keep things from fluttering across the south lawn in the breeze. On the third day, going stir-crazy behind the paper-stacked walls of my dark FEMA trailer and the Army compound itself, I canceled my afternoon meetings. I'd heard that D.C. had been free of animal hordes for more than 2 days now, and I wanted to see firsthand if it was true. I bumped into Sergeant Alvarez coming out of the compound's mess tent and convinced him to come with me. When I met him by the northwest gate a few minutes later, he was in full Kevlar and holding a smooth, flat black rifle with a cylinder on it. "How's the ankle?" I said. "Getting there. Like my walking stick?" he said, shaking a beast of a weapon. It was an automatic shotgun called an AA-12, he explained, which can fire the 32 rounds of double-aught buck in its drum in about an eye blink at full auto. "Which is ludicrously destructive when you think about it, but probably just the thing if we run into another tooth and claw mob," Alvarez concluded. "They just handed them out. I named mine Justin." "Justin? My man, just in case." Outside the White House gates, the city appeared peaceful, quiet. The quiet was the most amazing of all. You could hear the wind. The downtown area was still cordoned off, but they were beginning to allow some residents in to check on their property. We stopped and talked to several people coming in and out of the townhouses, a couple of student nurses from Georgetown, an FBI agent, a lobbyist, and her son. It was as though D.C. had become a village. For now. I was encouraged that people seemed to be upbeat and cooperative, but I knew this was only the beginning. This was still the honeymoon. How would people feel after a week of no hot showers or air conditioning? With the country's dependence on trucking for food delivery, how long would it be before people started getting hungry? We were on Constitution Avenue when the dog appeared from around the corner. It was a black lab, and with knee-jerk immediacy, Alvarez hoisted his new toy to his shoulder, ready to blast the dog to kibbles and bits. But the dog didn't even glance at us. It passed by in the street, pausing just long enough to relieve itself on a fire hydrant. Alvarez and I looked at each other. Then we burst out laughing. "Call the Times. I have tomorrow's headline," I said. "Dog pisses on hydrant." Chapter 94. That night and almost all the next day, Charles Groh and I attended romantic candlelit policy meetings with the CDC and various branches of the military. After a quick dinner, I was catching a half nap on a couch in a FEMA trailer parked on the south lawn when I felt an impish tug on my foot. I sat up, and NSA Chief Leahy sat down beside me. Leahy and the NSA had been put in charge of monitoring the effect of the industrial and power shutdown on the animal populations. I'd been waiting to hear back from him. He smiled enigmatically and handed me a cup of coffee. "Well, the suspense is killing me," I said, yawning, taking the coffee. "What's the story, Morning Glory?" Leahy's smile brightened and broadened. "Come see, boy genius." We left my trailer and headed into another one near the Rose Garden that had a satellite dish wired to the side of it. There was a rattling hand-crank generator hooked up to the trailer. It was a comm room. There were a dozen techs and military people barking into phones, staring at monitors, pointing at bright shiny things on screens. Leahy peeled some sheets off of a fax and handed them to me. "Feast your eyes on these, Wizard of Oz," he said. "On the Thursday before the shutdown, we were getting national reports of thousands of attacks every day. Now look at yesterday's tally in the U.S. I glanced at the sheet. "Am I reading this right?" "Three?" I said. "Exactly," Leahy said. "Not only that, we're getting in more and more stories about dogs returning to their owners. The industrial and communications freeze really has knocked out the airborne pheromone. Your plan wasn't just a home run, Oz. It was a grand slam. You're going to be very famous. I think you may have just saved the world." Leahy put his arm around my shoulder. "That's why we're going to get you out of here, kiddo. I pulled some strings. I'm going to get you back to your family in Nueva York." I looked at him. Was that even possible? It felt like weeks since I'd seen Chloe and Eli. "Surely you're joking." "No, siree. And don't call me Shirley. They're gassing up your chariot as we speak. You're on the G6 again." I thought about Chloe, about the actual possibility of touching my wife, holding her, burying my face in her neck. And Eli, I wanted to put that kid up on my shoulders and just walk around with him and show him everything that... I stopped. What the hell was I doing? What was I thinking? What were they offering? To let me break the rules? And if they pulled some strings for me, how many others were they pulling them for? "Hold it," I said. "Wait a second. I'd love more than anything to see my family, but it's too soon. There can't be any travel now. No combustion engines, no electricity for at least 2 weeks. That was the plan. You know this." "One 20-minute plane trip won't break the camel's back, Oz. You deserve this." "Deserve?" I said, feeling a bubble of fury flare up inside me. I grabbed him by the lapels. "That's Washington, isn't it? The rules are for the little people, right? We deserve it. Which part of the continuation of civilization do you morons not understand? You think this shutdown is the end? This is the beginning of the beginning of the beginning." "Let go of my jacket," Leahy said. I shoved him away. "Do you think this will work without real sacrifice? Without everyone's sacrifice? The bans on gas, cell phones, electricity, they have to be for everybody. The NSA, the military, VIPs, hell, even the president and the Holy Congress.
This is just stage one, don't you understand? We have to do this until we come up with a permanent solution.
If everything goes back to normal, then it's going to be feeding time again at the zoo, Leahy.
You tell all the fat cats to cork the champagne and cancel the tea times. It's time to suck it up like the rest of us.
Relax, Leahy said. I get the picture, I understand. You're right.
Do you?
I wonder, I said as I was leaving. But I hope so, for the sake of the world.
Chapter 95. On Saturday morning, I blew off every meeting on my schedule. The Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works wanted a meet and greet, as did a group of clinical pathologists from the CDC. But after the row with Leahy, I was almost sick to death of policymakers who were looking at this thing as if it were already over. For them, this was just something they could pad their resumes with, tell their grandchildren about. They needed to understand that if they didn't take it seriously, there weren't going to be any grandchildren to tell it to. Instead, I did something useful, something that needed doing. I signed up to help a contingent of Marines clean the streets and collect the bodies of the dead. There was something turn of the century about it. That is, the turn of the last century. Horses had been brought in from a farm in Rockville, Maryland to pull U-Haul trailers. By noon, the trailers were laden with body bags. Having served in Iraq, I thought I could handle the detail. I was wrong. The first child I encountered was a little Asian girl in an alley behind a dry cleaner shop in DuPont Circle. She looked about 8, 9 years old. Guts strewn across the alley like spaghetti. Sergeant Alvarez and I stuffed her in a bag and laid her down in one of the trailers. It broke me up. I snapped off my reeking rubber gloves and sat on the curb between a couple of parked cars for a while, weeping. So many lives had been lost. It was early evening when we arrived in Arlington National Cemetery. Near the Tomb of the Unknowns, the contents of the horse-drawn trailers were unloaded into a row of portable morgue units. An army bugler played taps as we were leaving. It was getting dark by the time Sergeant Alvarez and I made it on foot back across the bridge, heading for the Marine Corps base next to the White House. Near George Washington University, we were walking down a block lined with trees and bracketed with quaint homes, and I saw a chrome and yellow Hummer parked on the street, idling in front of a townhouse. When I reached in and shut off the engine, a tall, handsome guy wearing a Yankees cap and a rumpled blue suit ran out. He looked pissed.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" the guy said.
"I should ask you the same thing. Maybe you've been under a rock, but there's a ban on driving."
"No shit, Sherlock," the guy said, glancing at Sergeant Alvarez and showing me his ID. "I'm Gary Sterling, congressman from New York. This is my apartment. I'm heading back to Long Island to get a few things."
"Says who?" I said. He fished a document out of the inner pocket of his suit jacket.
"Says the president," he said, making little effort to suppress his smirk.
I looked at the piece of paper. I couldn't believe it. It was a presidential order that authorized the bear to operate a motor vehicle despite the ban. I looked at the president's seal and signature, dumbfounded. I guess I shouldn't have been that shocked, but I was. Everyone needs to follow the rules, except for the people who don't. I knew it. This was D.C. I was afraid this would happen. Representative Sterling snatched the permit out of my hand and promptly restarted his car. But I couldn't take it. Permit or no permit, I reached in and shut it down again. I took the keys out of the ignition.
"Are you blind? I showed you the permit," the congressman said.
I curled my right fist around the keys and raised my left. My fists were shaking. I knew what I was doing was crazy. But I guess I had seen too much that day. I'd seen too many dead bodies. Did this guy care? The answer was no, apparently.
"I don't give a shit," I said.
"You think the rules don't apply to you? You're above it, all right?"
"I don't think so. Fuck your permit. Come and get your keys."
And I put them in my pocket. Then what did he do? He simply turned on his heels and walked back up the townhouse steps. When he got to the top, he took out a cell phone, hit a button, and began speaking calmly into it.
"What the hell? This fool's 2 for 2. He's got a Hummer and a working cell phone?" Alvarez said.
A military Hummer roared up a couple of minutes later. Sergeant Alvarez stiffened and came to attention as a Marine colonel climbed out from behind the wheel. He spoke to Alvarez, and then Alvarez, very reluctantly, spoke to me.
I'm sorry, Oz, but it's true. They are issuing these permits, or whatever they are. It's legit. The asshole wins. You either have to give him back his keys, or I arrest you.
I bit my lip. I shook my head for a little while. Finally, I stopped. Fine, okay. You're right, everybody. I'm sorry. Got carried away, I said. The congressman came back down the townhouse steps. I walked over to him. I held the keys out to him at the curb. As he reached for them, I flung them aside into a storm drain. Whoops, I said. Clumsy me. My arms are kind of tired from carrying the dead all day. Truly, truly, my bad. Alvarez, even with the glaring colonel present, was having trouble burying his smile. I walked away, and nobody tried to stop me. Guy Smiley was beside himself, cussing like a sailor with a toothache, frothing with self-righteous indignation. He gave me the finger. Hey, that's nothing new, is it, Congressman? I gave him a little feminine wave. I'm an American citizen. Telling us to go fuck ourselves is what you guys are best at. But it was a brief, small victory. As I walked, still seething in the gloaming, I heard it from all over the city. Gasoline generators being started up, air conditioners humming back to life. All the vital people of the world were back to their old tricks, and I thought the bugle was sad. I realized it then. In the dying purple light as the sun set over Washington, I realized it. I listened to the gathering chatter in the dark, and I knew it. There would be no recovery. We had lost. It was over.
Chapter 96. By sundown of the third day of the big stop, as people have begun to call it, a loud chugging sound breaks the still, death-like silence in Midtown Manhattan. Playing Monopoly with Eli in a pale band of streaming sunlight in the apartment's back bedroom, Chloe hears it and goes to the window. She scans the sky over Central Park. The sound picks up volume, and then she sees it. Half a dozen tandem rotor Chinook helicopters are throbbing over the city, coming in from the west side. They pass through the gap between the skyscrapers of the Time Warner Center, which stands like a goalpost at the end of Central Park near Columbus Circle, and continue northeast across the rolling green of the park toward the government secure zone.
No,
Chloe whispers from the terrace.
No, no, no.
In the sky above them, now there is another roar. A 747 is shrieking westbound, its lights blinking red and green. It's the first plane she's seen in a week.
What is it?
Eli says.
Helicopters and planes,
Chloe says.
Why are they breaking the ban? It's been only 3 days.
She goes to the terrace. It's true. Across Central Park West, lights are beginning to twinkle on in the luxury apartment houses, like tiny pieces of luminous candy. She can hear generators whirring on, an ugly, hammering chatter. Down in the street, she watches as a truck screams onto Fifth Avenue from a side street, then a motorcycle, then a Mercedes SUV. It isn't just happening in New York, either. In the absence of animal attacks, people have become emboldened. The Air Force satellite picks up the imagery as lights start to flitter on in Dallas, in Cincinnati, in Dublin, Milan, Madrid. By the next morning, Beijing smokestacks are throwing up clouds of smoke, fluttering in the air like black satin scarves. The Canadian legislature overturns the cell phone ban. Mexico and the EU follow suit. All throughout the world, people go back to work. Coal plants are turned on, nuclear facilities, cell towers. Clouds of petrochemicals and hydrocarbons rise back into the air currents. Electromagnetic radiation emanates from cell phones and towers, buzzing, shimmering, sweeping across the land like an invisible poison gas. Chemical bonds click back together, reforming. Energy mixes with matter to create something new. Change is here to stay. It is the way of life, the way of the world. The big stop is over. So is human civilization.
Chapter 97.
On his sunny rock in Central Park, Attila awakens. Tense. So tense now. He can feel the adrenaline bulging his veins, pumping in his heart, sending blood to his brain and muscles. The flash of energy.
dendrites, synapses firing. The feeling surges in his body, warping the molecular structures in his brain, that hypersensitive lump of squishy electric meat. His blood pressure increases. His saliva dries as he begins to sweat. The hair on his back bristles. He is readying himself for attack. Something has triggered the attack impulse in his brain and left the switch on. His breath comes hard and heavy as his aggravation builds. His respiration comes in ragged huffing sounds, almost a snarl. The smell in the air is back, calling him, dragging him to his feet. The female beside him is seething as well, her eyes bright with anxious rage. The animals are back by the time he climbs down from the rock. They cover the softball field like a living rug. The pack is bigger and more bloodthirsty than before. Attila leads the swarm east toward the apartment building lights. His eye is trained on the terraces of the high-rises. He knows how to climb them, how to get in. He will go alone and open the doors for the others. The smell tells him this. This time, he will not fail. Any mercy he has shown to man is not even a memory anymore, because he has no memory. He has the smell. The smell is master, friend, mate. The smell is all. A man and a woman on a motorcycle are riding crosstown on the 65th Street transverse. Attila gives his pant-hoot call to herd the others, but it is unnecessary. In the pheromone cloud, sounds are unnecessary. The animals can smell what he wants in his breath and sweat. His orders become scents. The mass moves, anticipating him almost as easily as his own hand. A roaring cascade of bodies falls from a bridge onto the motorcycle. It is a husband and wife, both in their 50s. The woman is enveloped first. She screams as teeth and claws meet flesh. Attila, at the bottom of the scrum, gnaws chunks out of the woman's leg, blinking against the jet of arterial blood. The man, a retired cop from Queens, reaches for a sidearm that hasn't been there since 1999. A rat makes off with his left pinky up to the first knuckle. Then a squirrel attaches itself to his face with a squeak, clawing at his eyes. A Rottweiler bites into his crotch, and he sinks to the ground. The animals lacerate the people, carve them to ribbons as efficiently as the blades in an abattoir. In less than 3 minutes, all that's left of the two is very dirty laundry. Stained red with slaughter, Attila moves himself and the swarm toward the smell of humans. All the animals are moving together now with the same rhythm, like cells in the bloodstream. There is no Attila anymore. He is bigger now. Something else has broken through, taken over. He is only energy now. A soulless organization of bones and blood and meat, propelled by electricity and surging chemicals. He moves toward the sounds, toward the lights.
Chapter 98. Ah, how quickly the tide turned back, the blood-red tide. With the sounds of generators came screams and roaring gunfire. Were we really this stupid?
Yes, apparently.
It was just coming on midnight when the door of my trailer whacked open and Alvarez darkened the doorway behind it.
Grab your shit, Oz, we're overrun. They're evacuating the White House.
The East Wing had been overtaken, inside and out, hundreds of thousands of mammals. Dogs, raccoons, rats, squirrels, possums were streaming uphill into the iconic building, swarming like ants. The gunfire was constant now. As I ran alongside Alvarez, I saw a luminous orange glow lighting up the sky to the northeast. I pointed to it.
What's? The Capitol's on fire,
was all he said. We kept running. Alvarez rushed me into a waiting truck. The Marine guard at the east gate was down, blood running over his dress blues, his face chewed off. Alvarez glanced at him, raised his AA-12, and squeezed a lackadaisical stream of firepower in the direction of the handful of mold-spotted dogs still working on the body.
God help us,
Alvarez said, crossing himself.
Help us, I said. God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, didn't he? I know I'm just a scientist, but it looks like we've pissed him off again.
An hour later, I was wheels up in the air on an Air Force 737 back to New York. With the White House overrun, a new plan had been hatched. The government was moving north. Extremely north. About as north as you could get, actually.
The scientists and government were supposed to pack up and regroup at Thule Air Base in northern Greenland, 750 miles north of the Arctic Circle. The only good thing to say about it was that we were coming to New York first to get the other scientists who had come to the meeting. Great, I thought. That means I get to spend the apocalypse holed up in an igloo with Harvey Saltonstall. Then they told me Harvey had been mauled to death by dogs. Oh, I said. They said family had to stay behind, but I was having none of it. I found Leahy up near the plane's cockpit. Reluctant to throw any of my weight around until up to this point, I threw it around now as hard as I could. You either have my wife and kid on the tarmac, Leahy, or you shitheels can go to Greenland and figure it out by yourselves. When Chloe and Eli came through the airplane's door, I tackled them into a seat. We hugged each other and cried for about 10 years. For a short, dark time, I thought I might never see them again, but luckily for once I was wrong. The plane kicked its heels and was airborne again. It began to rain when we were zipping over Canada, but the plane ascended to a higher altitude. As we broke above the clouds, a bright, luminous glow came into the cabin. High off to our right, a full moon was rising bright and clear in the cold, and the clouds skirted by beneath us like a river of silver silk. That's when Eli saw something.
Daddy, look!
He was sitting in my lap, pointing out the window. Rising from a cloud to the east was some kind of mass, a kind of dark, moving cone, it looked like. A cloud? It was black, dense, flapping, alive. We seemed to be flying toward it. Or did it come toward us? At first, I thought it was a cloud of birds. More birds in one place than ever imaginable. But then I realized they were bats. They were swarming in an upside-down pyramid, revolving incessantly, mindlessly flying around and around, chasing each other, endlessly moving up and up. Bong! Seatbelts! Was all I heard on the PA system. Then, we flew into them. I grabbed my wife and son and held them to me as what sounded like the fist of God pounded on the plane. The bats flapped against the aircraft, spattered on the windows, were sucked into the engines, and shot out like bloody confetti, a vast black cloud of frantic scurrying and flapping. The starboard engine blew out a moment later, and in another moment we were descending. I closed my eyes and pressed my family to my heart as we plummeted, screaming toward the earth. Luckily, in a word, our pilot was an Iraq war vet, used to evasive maneuvers. We dropped several thousand feet in only a few seconds. But after we came out of the bat tornado, the pilot got the engine working again, somehow, and he turned the plane around and headed south and west. We were able to make an emergency landing in Syracuse. Other planes weren't so fortunate, we learned. Three airliners were downed, hundreds more gone. How many would die in this war before it was over? I thought as I huddled in Hancock International Airport's crowded terminal with my family. I didn't know. No one did. Epilogue. Thule Air Base, Connaught, Greenland. Part of me still believes that it's possible to turn the world around. I don't know how yet, but we will. The greatest known power in the universe is the resilience of man coupled with his intellect. He tinkers and tests and fights through to solutions. How noble in reason, as Hamlet said. How infinite in faculty, in apprehension. How like a god. I know we will make it. Because from where I write this, I can see my son Eli. As I look upon his innocent face, so like his mother's, there is only one thing, one feeling that lingers. The love my mother and father gave me grows inside of him, day by day, and one day he will pass it on to his wife and child, and it will continue. We will survive because, although we make a mess of things, we have the hope and faith and will to make things better for ourselves and for those we love. Making things better is what we do. Is it? I don't know. Maybe. I am recording this from a bunker. It's November, the cold season, and temperatures here hover around minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit. It is dark outside now. It's almost always dark here in our new, frigid home. The wind makes the wall shudder. I hear its constant, whistling howl even in my dreams now, as if the earth itself is in mourning. In the nearly 24-hour darkness, 60-mile-an-hour winds howl off the mountains onto the white desert of the ice cap. Almost no mammals live here, so we are blissfully safe in using our generators and radios. Lucky us. No matter how bad it is, I put on my Arctic suit and go outside once a day to stare forlornly at the brutal horizon. I consider it a kind of pilgrimage of sorts, a penance for my sins, for all our sins. It doesn't make me feel better, but I do it anyway. I guess I have finally found religion in a way. I suppose the end of the world will do that. There have been several suicides, mostly among Washington people, senators and representatives accustomed to soft living. There is no soft living now. Communication with the continental U.S. is sporadic. Supplies still seem to be coming in, but there are rumors of chaos back in the States. Lawless bands of people roam the streets, fighting animals and one another. For years, some in our country have advocated modern man's return to nature. It seems as though they have finally gotten their wish. In the hours of isolation and boredom, I think about what has happened. Unlike many of my colleagues, I don't blame technology. Petroleum improved human life. So did cell phones. No one knew that the combination of the two would eventually lead to biological disaster. We screwed up. It happens. But I dream that dream again last night. I dream it often. The dream of the death spiral. The ants I saw once in Costa Rica. There was a circle in the sand, somewhere in the desert. The squirming black whirlpool. Thousands and thousands of ants, all running together in an endless circle. Blindly, they follow each other. Each one locked onto the pheromone trail of the ant in front of him. Running themselves in circles, circles. Running themselves to death. A closed loop. A snake biting its tail. A symbol of futility. Locked in their loop, the ants run around and around in circles. Desperate. Stupid. Doomed.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Zoo, written by James Patterson and Michael Ledwidge, read by Jay Snyder. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Recorded by Jared O'Connell. Post-production by Denny Meltzer. Music by Freddie Caw. Zoo is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2012 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2012 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.